Our gospel reading this morning begins with this beautiful moment. Jesus Christ is walking in the temple on the feast of the dedication of the temple, or we might say the rededication of the temple. I'm going to give a little history to pull out that scene for a second before we move on to other pieces. The temple was the place of the special presence of God. We know that God is in one sense everywhere. It doesn't mean God is located in places, but that God is never far from us. We say that God is all-powerful and God is all-knowing. And as sort of a piece coming out of that, God is never too far to hear us and God is never too far to act. He is always near. And yet, the Bible in a number of different places talks about a special sense of presence or a special showing up of God. So for example, God walks in the Garden of Eden face to face with Adam and Eve. Or God brings his people out of bondage in Israel, out of slavery in Israel, and he leads them by a pillar of cloud during the day and a pillar of fire at night. And after that, he gives the law to Moses and continues to meet with Moses a number of times. And each time, Moses' face shines with a reflection of the glory of God. After this, God instructs his people to build a tabernacle, a traveling tent, sort of a traveling temple. And he says that he is specially present in that temple. And later they build a true temple, a permanent temple, or what was supposed to be a permanent temple. And again, God is uniquely present in the temple. His glory dwells in the Holy of Holies. In one sense, it's hidden away from people, just as the reflected glory of God is hidden by the veil that Moses shows over his face, wears over his face after meeting with God. The Holy of Holies is hidden away by a curtain, separated from the rest of the temple, so that only the selected priest once a year would kind of go in and be in that place of glory. We experience, or at least encounter, something like this presence of God each Sunday in the Eucharist. Through all of our time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days of year, God is close to us. God is never far away. There's nowhere we can go. There's nothing we can do that we then can say, well, God is far away and I can't reach him now or he can't reach me now. God is always present with us. And yet we are taught that in some way we have a different kind of encounter with God when we take communion, as we'll do in a little while. God is specially present in or with the bread and the wine. And as Anglicans, we don't try to work out exactly how that happens, sort of philosophically and all of that. What exactly is God doing that makes him specially present? But we do say he really is present. It's not just a symbol. Or I'll say communion is not just a spiritual exercise that we perform to think about the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, but in some way we encounter God as we receive it. We don't have to work out all of the hows of that. But in some way, God is specially present in the bread and wine. Well, so God was in some way specially present in the temple. And yet because of their rebellion against God, because of their unfaithfulness, the people of God were taken into exile and the presence of God disappeared from the temple. It's described in the Old Testament as the glory lifting from where it dwelt in the temple and departing from Israel. Now, that doesn't mean that God was done with his people. It doesn't mean God was inaccessible. It doesn't mean they stopped worshiping. It does mean that this special presence was gone. And that even though they began to be restored from their exile, brought back to the land, and even though they rebuilt a temple, nevertheless, that special sense of the presence of God is never described as returning to Israel. They had a place of worship still, but that sense of God dwelling with them was missing. And in one of the very powerful moments of their history, the Assyrian army came in and actually desecrated the temple. They basically took over the Jewish people, and then they used the temple for their own other religion. The holiest place of God was used for other things. But in a story that's described for us in the Apocrypha, which are books of devotion to God, which we don't see as equal to Scripture, but they're still worth our reading, in the books of the Maccabees, it describes a group of Jewish people who rise up in rebellion against the Assyrian army, and they fight them off, and they take back the land, and they take back the temple, and they restore the temple, they rededicate it to God, and they continue their worship. And that rededication is the feast that Jesus is celebrating here. It's tied up with the Feast of Dedication and the Feast of Lights, which we would know as Hanukkah. These two kind of feasts that go together in a sense. They celebrate the return, the rededication of the temple. But again, even though worship continues, and even though God is accessible to them in the sense that they pray and they worship, that special sense of God being present and dwelling with the people hasn't been restored. And now here in this scene, God himself, although they don't recognize him, is in the temple. God has returned to the temple, but he's returned as a fully human man who is also fully God. God is not hidden away in the Holy of Holies. He's walking around the temple. It's a beautiful moment. It's a beautiful scene, and it's unexpected. Here they've been waiting, and I would imagine many of the Jewish people have stopped even thinking about the presence of God. They're not so much waiting for the restoration of that presence because they don't even understand what they're missing anymore. And yet here the presence has returned to the temple. And then something very disturbing happens. We have this beautiful moment, this beautiful image, and then a group of people gather around Jesus. And we can miss it in the text because it seems kind of subtle. But if you look at the language is actually pretty strong. It's not that a group of people sort of show up in front of Jesus. It's a group of people circle him. They gather around him in a way that should be pretty intimidating to most people. Here you are walking through the temple. I imagine Jesus praying and talking to his Father. And all of a sudden, a group of men gather around him and they're in his space. And they're all around him. He can't go anyway to kind of get out of them without forcing his way past them. He's getting kind of mobbed. And they say to him what in our translation is, how long are you going to keep us in suspense? It's actually a Greek idiom that the translators don't know exactly how to translate. It doesn't, because idioms are figures of speech and they don't really go from one language to another. In fact, I've looked at kind of funny books as I've been trying to work on different languages and different times of idioms. And if you translate them literally, they're kind of hilarious sometimes. They make no sense to us. Well, this is a Greek idiom. And so, how long will you keep us in suspense kind of gets some of the meaning of it, but it doesn't get the tone of it. A different translation I looked at said, how long will you steal our life? To make that more of an idiom of ourselves, Jesus, you're killing us. You're killing us, Jesus. When are you going to come out and just say it? Are you the Messiah or not? Just say it already. I don't love politics, but it's hard not to get some of the news. And it seems like every day in the news, there's a question of, is this person running for president or not? Mostly for the Democratic primary. But there's, last count, I think 21 people running. But each day or each week, there'd be another person, they'd say, well, is this person going to declare or not? And it sure looks like they are. I mean, he's showing up in Pennsylvania for no particular reason, and he seems to be raising money, and this woman is showing up at a bunch of other states that are going to be swing states, and she seems to be giving a lot of speeches. Maybe she's going to run or not. And every chance a reporter gets, they go up to him and say, so are you declaring for president or not? And then the people will show up on late-night talk shows and for no reason at all, right? And then the host will say, well, are you making it official tonight? Or are you going to declare for president? It's like, well, you know, I really am thinking about my options, and I really care about this country. Okay, that's not an answer. We just come out and say it one way or another. So we can look at it kind of like that. But there's so much going on, so much more going on with Jesus here. Here's a group that's gathered around him. There's this sense of almost like an oppressive, dangerous kind of feeling to it. And they're saying, tell us one way or another, Messiah or not. And Jesus, in one sense, does not answer their question directly. And in another sense, makes it perfectly clear that he has already made it perfectly clear. Why won't he just say yes? I think two reasons. One, they are clearly planning something here. And for him to say, yes, I am the Messiah, would begin a chain of events that he doesn't want to happen. See, his supporters, the people who already believe in him, have one idea of what a Messiah would be. The Messiah is God's anointed king. So that means we got to get an army together and we got to get a political party together. We're going to throw off the oppression of Rome. So as soon as you say you're Messiah, Jesus, we are ready to gather swords and spears, and we're going to start a battle right now against this empire of Rome. And Jesus doesn't want to do that. They don't understand what the Messiah actually is. Or they don't understand the fullness, and they don't understand the way God's going to do what he's going to do. He doesn't want to start that chain of events. He doesn't want to knock that domino over. All the more so with a group like this that opposes him, because if he says to them, yes, I am the Messiah, they're going to say, great, let me go talk to that centurion over there and see if we can have you arrested before it's too late. Because they don't want to believe in him. They're not here to follow him as Messiah. They're here to get rid of him and deal with him. And so if they can get him to declare himself the king of Israel, then they can immediately go to Rome and say, hey, there's a terrorist around. Deal with him. So there's that piece. He doesn't want to knock that first domino over. But more than that, deeper than that, no one seems to really understand what the Messiah is. And no one seems to understand that Jesus is more than the Messiah at this point. See, the Messiah is God's chosen king, his anointed one is literally what it means. The one like King David, but more than King David. The one that God will use to restore his people to what they're meant to be. But there are these hints, even in the Old Testament, that the Messiah is more than they think. As Jesus will later point out, or in different part of the Gospels point out to them, there's a point at which King David refers to the Messiah as his own Lord. And how is that possible? Because David is supposed to be the ancestor of the Messiah. Can't imagine calling your descendant your Lord. That doesn't make any sense. There's something else going on there. And slowly Jesus reveals to them that he's not just the Messiah, he's also the suffering servant of Isaiah. So he's not just the one anointed to be king, he's also the one who's going to suffer on the behalf of God and his people. And they had no idea those things would go together. But even bigger than that, there's this whole set of prophecies in the Old Testament that talks about what God will do to restore his people. And those are less predictions than they are promises. God saying, I will rescue my people. I will transform them. I will set them free. I will dwell with them again. And Jesus is playing a role in that script, in those promises of God, but he's not playing the role they expect. He's not playing the human that Jesus or that God the Father will use to accomplish his ends. He's actually playing the role of God. He is doing the things that God does in those promises. So all throughout these Old Testament promises, there are things like, I will come and heal you. And Jesus does that himself. There's even language in some of these Old Testament promises that says things like, God will walk upon the waters. And we literally see Jesus walk on the water. It doesn't say, I will have an anointed human being who will do really neat miracles like walking on the water. It says God will walk on the waters. And it says God will forgive sins. And we have Jesus actually forgiving sins. And here at the end of this gospel passage, we actually have Jesus saying, the Father and I are one. And he clearly doesn't mean, sometimes I show up as the Father and sometimes I show up as the Son, or sometimes I pretend to be the Father and sometimes I pretend to be the Son. No, because he clearly talks to the Father. So they're two different persons. And yet, he says, we are so united that we are one. Saying that makes him equal to God the Father. He's claiming to be on the same level as God the Father. If he's wrong, he's blasphemous and probably crazy. And if he's right, he too is God. And so when they ask, are you the Messiah? The answer is yes, but so much more than you understand. And for him simply to answer with a direct yes doesn't just knock over that set of dominoes that's going to lead to war and rebellion and all sorts of things like that, but it puts him in a box, and he's much bigger than that box. It's a true answer, but also a misleading one. I'm so much more than you think, he's telling them. But look what he says about their reaction. To paraphrase him, I have given you plenty of evidence of who I am. I have shown you who I am. And if you really wanted to know, you would know by now. But you don't recognize who I am because you don't want to know. Because you don't belong to me. You are not sheep of the shepherd. That's a powerful statement. But it's also just clearly true in this context. Remember, they're not sitting at his feet going, look, we have seen you heal. We have seen you teach the law. We have seen you work miracles and works of compassion. We've seen you teach the scriptures in a way that opened them up like no one else could do. We have seen God with you and working through you so clearly that we know that God approves of your message. So teach us more. He's not saying that, or they're not saying that. Rather, they're saying, Jesus, we're already angry with you. We want to deal with you. We want to get rid of you. So spell it out. Who are you? So that we know what to do with you. They are coming to him with hostility. Now, I've never experienced that kind of hostility. But I think all of us have probably had a conversation with someone in which you realize somewhere in the conversation, there's nothing I can say that will actually communicate with this person right now. They're too angry, they're too unreasonable. Maybe we can have a conversation later, but right now there's nothing I can say that's going to get through. There's nothing I can say right now that will communicate and be heard. Well, there's a sense in which God is saying to them, you are perpetually living in that state. There's nothing God can say to you right now that's going to get through. You're too angry at God, or you're too pushing away God. Nothing that God will say is going to get through to you right now. God is saying to this group of people at that time, you won't listen, and you won't see me, and you won't hear me. And by contrast, those who belong to me do. And here he doesn't give an explanation so much of how you become his sheep. He's not working out the theology to say, well, either it's because I decided ahead of time who my sheep would be, and I made that happen against their will or irrelevant to their will, or I gave everybody the choice and some people chose me and some people didn't. Here he's not explaining one way or another. He's not giving a systematic theology of how salvation works exactly, the how of it. He is simply saying, there are people who belong to me and people who don't. And the people who don't belong to me are not going to listen to me. But by contrast, my sheep, the people who belong to me, hear my voice and they follow me. They're known by me and they follow me. And here are those two pieces, because those are the essential pieces in a sense, of what it means to be Christians. You have the intimacy of a relationship with a shepherd, and you have the obedience of belonging to and following the shepherd. They hear my voice and they know me, and they follow me. And it's not you do one to get the other or anything like that. He doesn't give an order of those things. He just said that's what's clearly true. How do you know what shepherd sheep belong to? They recognize him and have a relationship with him, and they follow him. Sometimes we get really caught up in questions of worth and what do you do to be worthy of God and what do you do to earn something with God or things like that. And we either try to earn something with God or we're afraid of trying to earn something with God. But here, at least in this image, that's just not even part of it. It's just obviously true that those who belong to God love him and follow him. The sheep don't try to earn the respect or the acceptance of a shepherd, nor do they worry about not earning it. They just come when he calls because they know him and trust him and love him and follow him. And that's the relationship we're called to. We are called to know and love God, to have a relationship with him, where the very creator of the world knows us, knows you, and knows me. And we can actually hear his voice and relate to him in a personal way. And also, we're called to follow him in obedience. And I think part of what Jesus is saying here is those two things just naturally follow from belonging to the shepherd. And if they're not there, something's terribly wrong. So again, salvation is not about kind of making a commitment at one point and then going on with your life. It's not about saying a prayer one time and then going on with your life as if that didn't happen. However exactly salvation happens, in terms of, did you pray when you were a small child with someone? Did you pray on a certain Sunday? Did you go to a camp and make a decision? Is it that you were baptized as a child and then slowly grew into your faith? Did you belong to church and then leave for 20 years and then come back? Did you make a dramatic decision or did you make a slow, progressive decision to follow Jesus? However it happened for you, or however it will happen for you, what becomes clear is you belong to God when you have a relationship with him and you become a follower, an obedient, committed follower of his. And those two things go together. It's not you do one and then someday you do another. You are belonging to God if you know him and follow him. And hear this last piece. He says, and he even says it twice to be really clear. What belongs to me as the shepherd, nobody can steal from me. It's a perfect image because of the shepherd idea. See, in some ways, being a shepherd is really hard work, and in some ways, it's really simple. The sheep know how to eat. You just put them where grass is, and they'll eat it. You put them where it's a nice, cool, shady place, and they'll lay down and sleep. You put them where their water is, and they drink it. So you got to be outside, and you know, you might get rained on, you might get cold, all that kind of stuff, but it's not complicated work. But the moments that really matter are the ones in which the sheep are in danger. That's when the shepherd really earns his pay. When one sheep gets lost and they have to go search for that sheep and bring it back to the flock. Or when there's a predator that's going to attack the sheep. Right? the lazy shepherd doesn't keep an eye out and may discover at the end of the day that they lost one or two sheep along the way, either to predators or carelessness. The cowardly shepherd sees a predator like a lion and says, "Whoa, it's not worth my job. This lion's probably only going to take one or two sheep. Let him have that. It's not worth risking my life." The good shepherd doesn't lose any sheep. He keeps an eye out. He holds on to them. And here at the end of the gospel passage for today, Jesus says, "The sheep that belong to me, I will never, never, never lose. No predator can take them from me, and I will never be careless to lose them. Nothing can take my sheep from me." Which means we can't wander off and get lost. God will come after us. And no force in heaven or earth can rip us away from God. Which is to say, if you are a sheep that belongs to the good shepherd, you are safe with him. You are safe with him. It's a whole other question about whether you can decide not to be a sheep anymore. If you can decide deliberately not to follow God anymore, we'll set that aside for this morning. But if you want to belong to Jesus, nothing can take you from him. And I can't give a list of all the nothings out there. But I want you to understand, that includes your own failures. We, each and every one of us, fail to live up to the commands of God. And I've emphasized this morning how important it is that we follow God and not just seek the relationship with him. But we will fail as we follow him from time to time, sometimes even in great ways. And yet even that cannot pull us from the hand of God. God will forgive you if you want him to. And you can't be ripped from God by any circumstances of life. Some of us have gone through tragedies and challenges. And some of those can feel so painful that we start to ask, is God done with me? If God really loved me, would he let this happen? Because he didn't stop this, does it mean he doesn't love me? The answer is no. Nothing can tear you from his hands. No circumstance can separate you from God. Nothing. Not death. Not any situation in this life. And so this Sunday, it is Good Shepherd Sunday as well as Mother's Day. Pray that you trust the shepherd. If you haven't yet become one of his sheep, I pray that you will come to be one. Begin trusting him now. If you want help with that, you can talk to me or pretty much anyone else here. We would be happy to sit down and talk with you, answer questions, pray with you. And you can do that at coffee hour, or you can do that sometime during the week with me. But if you haven't yet trusted the shepherd, this is a great time to do it. If you have already entered into that trust, sometimes it's daily effort to keep trusting him. When it gets hard, when you get weary, when the suffering is too much, it's hard to trust that that shepherd is holding on to you. We ask you again to trust him. I was praying with the choir and some of the different people serving in the service today before we started. And as I was praying, I included praying about Mother's Day and that this would be a celebration for the mothers here. But the thought came to me also to remember to pray for those who it's a hard day. Some of you have lost your mother, and you're praying about that. Some of you have lost children, and that's incredibly painful. And each year is a reminder of that. Others of you wanted to have children and haven't been able to for whatever reason, or haven't been able to yet. It can be an incredibly painful day as well as a celebratory day. And that too is a place to trust the shepherd. Trust that he loves and cares for you in the midst of suffering and loss and pain. Let it be a joyful, celebratory day for some, and a day of trust and holding on and finding peace for others. The scripture commands us to celebrate with those who celebrate and mourn with those who mourn. And that can be a tricky thing to do, but we do. And even if we have a hard time with that, the Good Shepherd doesn't. He mourns with us and he celebrates with us. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.